how do the two fit together? I'll just do for right now like a little overview of where this is going before you get on the train, so you know where it's headed. What the term spiritual economics means, as defined by these economists, what the conventional sense of economics means, basically consumer economics. What studies have shown, what are the impacts on the human experience of consumer economics, what are interpersonal impacts, consumer economic, but are environmental impacts of consumer economics. And it spells there's something fundamentally missing in the picture with consumer economics. The next will be to look at alternatives, green economics, very popular. And while that does something where is there shortfall in green economics, and then the economists themselves looking at spiritual economics. And that's where we're headed. That's the sequence. The definition of spiritual economics given by these economists themselves is placing spiritual well-being as the prime necessity of human life and the basics of economic progress. The consumer economics doesn't view things this way. You know, the how well your economy is going is two basic criterion: how much you produce and how much you consume. Production and consumption makes for healthy economics. So the spiritual economics advocates say that spiritual well-being should be that driving force and the determining factor of economic progress. Here's one of the contributors to this book, former World Bank advisor, and after his career involved in the World Bank, he started coming to these conclusions, which are: today the major challenge in front of us is the reconciliation between the material and non-material dimensions of our human existence, the reconciliation between economics and spirituality. I'll just underscore this thought. Somebody that I personally know, a young Indian man who is in New Zealand, he his field is accounting. I don't think of accounting as something I get very excited about, but he did his PhD on this very theme, that in accounting, the main consideration of how you look at accounting is profit and loss. And his PhD thesis was to show how that's incomplete, because there are losses that are soft, like in the human side, and human well-being, and so forth. And therefore, his presentation was you have to look at the whole of the person or the groups of persons or society to say, accounting has its profits and losses in terms of softer issues, and they have to be calculated if you're going to have a sustainable system of accounting. Very similar to simply economics. So this model, this diagram is taken right from his article. Economics is a subset of our larger spirituality. Same author. At the center stage of the debate of what economics should be all about, there is a fundamental fact we must not forget. That is, we are human beings, that we human beings are living on this planet not just in pursuit of material welfare. So if everything shrinks down to material welfare and that's the basis of economics, his presentation is it's uneconomical in the long run. It's unsustainable. It's unwholesome, unhealthy. And we're going to look at some of the reasons why that's so. A radical change is something that's warranted, is something that economists themselves are presenting. Lester Brown, Earth Policy Institute, There's his picture up there. Our global civilization today is on an economic path that is environmentally unsustainable, a path that is leading us toward economic decline and collapse. And the illustration is not just global warming. It's the economic picture is environmentally destroying the planet. We'll go into that in just a bit. Consumer economics has these three components: material incentives, you know, to gain and to prosper and to become wealthy and to become successful, and by those standards. And the measure of that is production and consumption. And at what point does one become satisfied? The answer is there is no point where one becomes satisfied. However much one has, I know a few people that are involved in business, and one of the things that they've shared with me is you always have to keep growing. If you don't keep growing, you're going to fold. So it has to be continually expanding, and to the point where you may sell the business and bail, but for that business to continue being successful, it has to keep expanding. And does that model make people happier? So now there's a whole section of what economists themselves have studied, because starting the post-World War II era, the economy really boomed, and there was money to have economists study what makes the economy boom and what might bring it down. So from that time, lots of studies have taken place, and the finding is that amidst the satisfaction people feel with their material progress, there is a spirit of unhappiness and depression haunting advanced market democracies throughout the world. It should be that when we have affluence that enables us to have more choices, you put the affluence together with more choices and people become better off. But studies show otherwise. This is a chart showing the average income of people in the United States from the period of the late 1950s going up until 2005, or just before 2005. The lower chart is people, they're doing self-analysis and they report themselves as being happy. So this is one study. Professor Myers has done this study over those years. And nothing much is happening, and people reporting that whether they're happy or not. But the income is going up. This is a video clip of Daniel Kahneman saying the same thing. He's, interestingly, he's a Princeton University professor that got a Nobel Prize in economics, because he was studying the psychological effect of prosperous economies and how does it impact on the quality of people's lives. So here's Professor Kahneman speaking. Oh, one of his co-professors was a gentleman named Professor Easterlin. And Easterlin very humbly named his study after himself, the Easterlin Paradox. And here's Professor Kahneman speaking about it.
This is called the Easterlin Paradox. And what it shows is income and happiness in the United States. This is the percentage of Americans who describe themselves as very happy as a function of time between the years 1946 and 1996. And you see two curves there. One curve that seemed to be rising, that simply is GDP per head. And the other curve is the percentage of people who, the curve that isn't going anywhere in particular, is the percentage of people who describe themselves as very happy. Now this is really a problem, I think, because people do want to get rich. I mean, there's no question about it. They want to get richer. They want their standard of living to increase. And yet when everybody's standard of living is increasing, as we see in this graph quite steadily over the last 60 years, little, if anything, happens to well-being. And that is a deep puzzle, I think. And economists in general simply were paying no attention to this. In recent years, this has been recognized as a difficulty, as something that needs to be grappled with.
So he's summarized the point that is now going to be illustrated by other economists who have studied economy in the United States and reached the same conclusion. This is Professor Kasser. Here's his some credentials at the bottom, studies that he's done over the period of spanning 10 years, where affluence, when it's higher, the findings are there's an increased anxiety, depression, physical symptoms, unpleasant emotion, and drug and alcohol use. Physical symptoms meaning people are less contented with their life. Whereas lower levels of income, people report there's greater degree of self-actualization, vitality, life satisfaction, and pleasant emotions. So another professor that has studied this has written a book called Tyranny of Choice. And his name is Barry Schwartz. He's a professor at Swarthmore. I'm from upstate New York, so I know it's about Swarthmore. It's a little liberal arts school where, at least when I was growing up, it's where wealthy, spoiled kids go to school. Kind of, you know, liberal arts and not really. Anyway, so that's where he's a professor of economics. And he describes this, in fact, he's coined a term in his writing, maximizers. You'll see that in a minute. Americans value freedom, is his premise. And with freedom, it means we can make choices. And when we have the more choices that are available to us, one should expect greater freedom, greater happiness. And the studies that he's done show it's just the opposite. More affluence, more choices, less happiness. So here's a little interview. You see Barry Schwartz in action here.
We in the West, certainly in the United States especially, have taken for granted that the highest good is freedom, and the way to maximize freedom is to maximize choice. But there can be too much of a good thing. So paralysis into inaction, bad decisions, and dissatisfaction with good decisions are the things that plague many of us in a world where it seems as though freedom of choice is without limit. The most serious manifestation of this is the inability of kids when they graduate from selective institutions like the one I teach at to figure out what comes next. They are completely paralyzed with indecision. They go work at Starbucks hoping that one morning they'll wake up knowing what door to walk through.
Of course, that doesn't happen at Southern Illinois University because everybody is a different kind of student. But the studies that he's done, if you'll see a little bit in a moment, come from all spectrums of society, not just, you know, the wealthy elite. This term is so prominent, it's made its way into Webster's Dictionary. Here's just cut and paste from Webster's Dictionary. The term affluenza has the following definition: extreme materialism, which is the impetus for accumulating wealth and for overconsumption of goods. Also, feelings of guilt and isolation from the dysfunctional pursuit of wealth and goods. And it gives the example. Affluenza is the social disease caused by commercialism, consumerism, and rampant materialism, and its antidote is simple living. Webster's Dictionary. That's where we're going to head, is the simple living part at the end. So, maximizers pictured on the left side and satisfizer, these are, you know, the economists' terms, because when you're a professor, you have to, like, make up a new term and define it and use it and become known for having that term. So the maximizers is Barry Schwartz's term. and Kahneman is the satisficers. The satisficers, here's an example of the two. I'll give an example from a study that was done at Cornell University. Two ladies, economic professors at Columbia University, studied the outgoing graduates and the jobs that they tried to secure. So then they found from their study that there were these two groups, persons that agonized endlessly over what profession they would move into, what particular job market they would go for. And those that they found two things. The maximizers, the ones that endlessly pursued the very best, because part of the thing with a maximizer is not only you have to get the best, but your worth is that you get the best, because that's what you have to be. You have to be best. Very competitive and very selective. So they found that they got better paying jobs by a range of $10,000 to $15,000 per year more for the maximizers. But then the other side was, as far as whether they reported whether they were satisfied or not, much less satisfied. Whereas the satisficers, characterized by see what's out there out of choices, supposing you whether it's career or you want to buy a computer, or you buy a new car, or where you're going to go for your vacation, or choices that you have because you have the you have some affluence, you have the capacity to do so. The satisficers are persons who look around, check, here and there, and then they select and they move on. So satisficers, the studies have shown, are more satisfied, more contented. So we'll cover these four terms. These are economists' terms. This is, softer issues. It'll get into harder ones in a moment, but how people psychologically are feeling themselves to be better off. So opportunity costs. This is before you make the choice. You're looking out at the options in the marketplace. And before making the choice, there's a tension of, I need to make the right choice, maybe I'm not going to make the right choice. So with increased opportunity or increased chance of making choices, the level of happiness decreases. The chart on the left shows what one would expect is, as your number of choices increases going out, the positive emotions should increase, going up, and negative emotions should go down. But the finding is, it's not like that. It's more like a sine curve. It goes up, and then negative feelings start to increase as the number of choices increase. That's even before you make your choice. Here's Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, both from Princeton, stating, anticipation of losses make us hurt more than anticipation of gains make us feel good. So now somebody's made their choice, whatever it is that they're about to choose, and then they have some regret. They didn't make the right choice. Regret sensitivity is their term. And they find the more the range of choices, the deeper is the sense of regret. One example that comes to mind, I know somebody that they own a place in Denali National Forest. You know where Denali National Forest? You ever hear of that? It's in Alaska. So people go there because they want to see the moose and see the bear and most of all see Mount McKinley on a nice clear day. So people come from all over the world. They come from Japan. They come from Europe, all over the place. And they want to have a nice, the most pristine, several hundred thousands of acres of natural land. And when the number of days out of the year that people can actually see Mount McKinley when there's not clouds in the way is very few. So when they go, they spent all this money and they regret. they didn't get to see Mount McKinley. You can go up in a plane and try to see the thing and you can't see because it's covered by clouds. All that expenditure of effort and energy and wealth and time and deep regret for buying a car or, you know, buying a computer or something. You wanted to get the best model and it turns out the price dropped after you bought yours or something happened. Something. Regret. Sensitivity. People with high sensitivity to regret are less happy, less satisfied with life, less optimistic, more depressed. From the University of Virginia and Harvard, co-professors studying this, after getting the object, the happiness is up for some time, but due to what they call adaptation, you become accustomed to it. You buy a new car, you drive around your new car for some time, you like your new car, and after some time, the buzz is gone. So here's their comment. People consistently mispredict how long good experiences will make them feel good and how long bad experiences will make them feel bad. These are economists that are studying what keeps the economy going. And the consumer economy model doesn't keep the economy going in the way that they had hoped that it would. The greater expectation, this is another, high expectations. The greater the expectation is, the greater is frustration about making a poor choice. The New York Times and ABC did a combined study on children of wealthy parents. So high school kids in America who are born in families that are very wealthy. And they ask two questions. One question is, who has it tougher, you or your parents, when your parents were young, or you? And their answer was, we have it tougher. And why is it? Because there is so much expectation. If we don't match the level of affluence of our parents, the tension that we're expected, you know, to perform at, even if it doesn't suit us, it's like our parents have expectation, our peers have expectations, enormous amount of peer pressure, and our own expectations. And it's not only in affluence, it's all the other things that go along with an affluent society, social and so on. So here's their statement from Alex Nicholos, University of Northern British Columbia. All our evaluations of the things we do and buy depend on comparison to past experiences, to what we were hoping for, and what we expected. So, in summary, the emotional well-being of society, the internal sense of doing well because we're in an affluent society, doesn't match. In fact, there's a whole industry of depression. A friend of mine is a physician at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and this is his field. And he was sharing with me that next to heart disease, the number two money item in the medical field is depression. Americans spend the second most number of U.S. dollars in America dealing with depression. And his inside comment to me was, it doesn't work. Because there's pharmaceutical companies that do research, and they put their research out that says, you know, this new product has 85% success rate for people that have depression problems over the first year. He said what they don't say is that after the first year, the second year, and third year, they're back to the same place they were. Because the lifestyle hasn't changed. They still have this high expectation that I need to, and the wealthiest people are the biggest market for depression. Not only they can pay the the money to get the drugs or the rehabilitation or the whatever it is. But there's more incidents, at least more reported incidents amongst the affluent sector of society. Barry Schwartz, in his Tyranny of Choice, with group after group of people varying in age, including young adolescents, gender, educational level, geographic location, race, and socioeconomic status, we have found a strong correlation between maximizing and measures of depression. So, back to the very first premise that consumer economics is driven, its success is insatiable desires. How much what somebody is earning, do they say, that's enough, I don't need anything more? It doesn't happen like that. The very nature of what drives the economic system is this maximizing principle, and it leads to depression. These two gentlemen pictured in the right, they run, what do you call those things? Investment funds, I forget what you call them. So these are people that are like finance guys, and they're the Seligman Fund is one of them. Mutual fund, that's what you call them, right? Okay. So they know from the inside, not just scholars. In stark contrast to the improvement in economic statistics over the past 50 years, there's strong evidence that the increase of depression has increased enormously over the same period of time. So materialistic economics or consumer economics pushes people to become maximizers, and their well-being decreases. So I'm going to go quickly here. Barry Schwartz asks the question and then answers it, have we gone too far? And he says we've gone way too far for a long period of time. These are the two professors at Columbia University that did this study with the outgoing graduates at Columbia. Evidence is mounting that subjective and, in several cases, even objective well-being may be negatively affected by choice proliferation. So they're advocating decrease the possibility of choices so people will have better well-being. At least it should be considered. That's their conclusion. Now, moving into the next area, besides within the individual, there's interpersonal considerations. And the interpersonal considerations, in Heidelberg, there's an institute that studies international conflict. And they have found that over the past 50 years, last 50 wars, a good number of them is just fighting over the resources that are needed to drive consumer economics. This is because we've passed, according to a number of studies, we passed what the Earth can bear using the resources of Earth to create our production. So in 2003, we were using 1.25 Earth planets. But we can't do that because there's only one. We're taking the resources faster than the Earth can replenish by natural recycling. So they fight over resources. I can think of some wars where it's fights over resources. And the resources are reducing. In the United States, there's less than 4% of the original forests remaining, so we have to find some more forests. We go all around the world and look for forests that we can use. 80% of the planet's original forests are gone. And water, 40% of US rivers are undrinkable. Then there's the interpersonal dimension of the rich and the poor. In 1960, the GDP of the 20 richest countries was 18 times that of the 20 poorest countries. But just over a period of 35 years, it almost doubled. The gap between the richest and the poorest nations had more than doubled to 37 times. So the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. There's this social disparity through consumer economics. One example of this is in the Congo for production of electronics. A very important component is coltan. To get coltan, it's found in the Congo. So a lot of the children in the Congo, 30% of the children in Congo aren't going to school so they can mine coltan so we can have our electronic gadgets. And to have the electronic gadgets, you need factories. So this is a stunning statistic. 200,000 people a day move into cities to work in the factories that produce our stuff. And the production from the factories releases 4 billion pounds of toxins a year. So what that effect is, it goes into the air, and when it goes into the air, people breathe it. Studies have shown that breast milk contains the highest levels of many toxins. They've studied, you know, where the toxins go once you ingest them. So that one of the most natural things in existence is children taking breast milk from their mothers, they're drinking toxins because of the toxins that are put into the air through factories. And fatalities and injuries. 1.2 million fatalities each year, or 3,300 deaths a day from factory-related work. And 160 million new cases of diseases, work-related. It's the picture is there's something wrong here. Something to get strong economy, there's a loss that needs to be factored. 40% of the ocean areas are strongly affected, just the environmental concern, by the way that we're interacting with planet Earth. Largely that means, you know, the consumer economics program. Summary point. There is no longer any serious scientific dispute that the decline in every living system in the world has reached an extraordinary threshold. So we have huge environmental issues, interpersonal issues, inter and intrapersonal issues. It's a mess. And one, it's helpful to ask how we got into the mess, because if you can understand how you got into the mess, you have a clue how to get out. So the next is probably the best part of this whole presentation, because I'm not doing it. It's a storyofstuff.com. You can go to that website. I've just taken something from it, and explains, gives the answer to the question, how we got to where we are.
We have become a nation of consumers. Our primary identity has become that of being consumers, not mothers, teachers, farmers, but consumers. The primary way that our value is measured and demonstrated is by how much we contribute to this era, how much we consume. And do we? We shop and shop and shop, keep the materials flowing, and flow they do. Guess what percentage of total materials flow through this system is still in product or use 6 months after the date of sale in North America? 50%? 20? No. 1%. 1. In other words, 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through the system is trash within 6 months. Now, how can we run a planet with that level of materials throughput? It wasn't always like this. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. Ask your grandma. In her day, stewardship and resourcefulness and thrift were valued. So how did this happen? Well, it didn't just happen. It was designed. Shortly after World War II, these guys were figuring out how to ramp up the economy. Retailing analyst Victor Lebeau articulated the solution that's become the norm for the whole system. He said, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate. President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisors chairman said that the American economy's ultimate purpose is to produce more consumer goods. More consumer goods? Our ultimate purpose? Not provide health care or education or safe transportation or sustainability or justice? Consumer goods? How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. It's obvious with things like plastic bags and coffee cups, but now it's even base stuff. Mops, DVDs, cameras, barbecues, even everything. Even computers. Have you noticed that when you buy a computer now, the technology is changing so fast that in just a couple of years, it's actually an impediment to communication? I was curious about this, so I opened up a big desktop computer to see what was inside. And I found out that the piece that changes each year is just a tiny little piece in the corner. But you can't just change that one piece because each new version is a different shape. So you've got to chuck the whole thing and buy a new one. So I was reading industrial design journals from the 1950s when planned obsolescence was really catching on. These designers are so open about it. They actually discuss how fast can they make stuff break that still leaves the consumer having enough faith in the product to go out and buy another one. It was so intentional. But stuff cannot break fast enough to keep this arrow afloat. So there's also perceived obsolescence. Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Like, I've had the same fat white computer monitor on my desk for 5 years. My coworker just got a new computer. She has a flat, shiny, sleek monitor. It matches her computer, it matches her phone, even her pen stand. She looks like she's driving in Spaceship Central, and I look like I'm at a washing machine on my desk. Fashion is another prime example of this. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before, but polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the U.S., we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs, and then we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us you suck, so you got to go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you got to go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work-watch-thing treadmill, and we...
goes on, but that's my cutoff. The consumption era. So it wasn't accidental that we got to where we are. It's designed, part of the
we have become a
building of the economy, making us a more successful country. At the turn of the century, some studies were done to take a look at, you know, how did that previous century go. This is an article by Gary Gross describing the all-consuming century. The real winners of the century was consumerism. Visions of a political community of stable, shared values and active citizenship have given way to a dynamic but seemingly passive society of consumption in America and increasingly across the globe. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population but consumes 30% of the world's resources and creates 30% of the world's waste. Another way of saying the same thing is, if the entire planet consumed at the level that the United States consumed, we'd need three planets today. We don't have three planets today. And the rest of the world isn't consuming at the same level as the United States, but following their neighbors over here, the now growing prosperous nations are starting to consume at levels trying to compete with the United States. So that means same planet, same limited resources, more need for resources, more fighting over the resources. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. And for the consumer economy, you have to have more and more marketplaces. This is a little clip. I've met this person. He lives in Seattle. But it's a clip of a person who was traveling around the world to increase the consumer economy in the world, thinking this is good. It'll make everybody come up and they'll have more of what they need. So now he's rethinking his prior occupation. In fact, he's campaigning the opposite.
The whole corporate system in the course of globalization is increasingly geared up to bring every country into the consumer society. And there's a very strong emphasis on trying to reach children, to reshape their values from the very beginning, to convince them that progress is defined by what they consume.
Each day, television exposes millions of people in the developing world to the consumer dream, and they are eager to be included. David Corton once believed they could and should. He's worked in Africa, Asia, and Central America for the Harvard Business School, the Ford Foundation, and the Agency for International Development.
My career was focused on training business executives to create the equivalent of our high consumption economies in countries throughout the world. Gradually I came to realize that that wasn't working, it couldn't work. Many people's lives were actually worse off. We were seeing the environment trashed. We were seeing the breakdown of cultures and the social fabric.
One fifth of the world's people live in abject poverty, dying slowly of hunger and disease. Millions of others also desperately need more material goods. Yet were they to consume as much as we do, the result could be an environmental crisis.
There's absolutely no way that everyone in the world can live at that standard of affluence, because the Earth's ecosystem simply will not stand it. Just imagine if every Chinese household had two cars.
As this car show in Beijing reveals, they're already on that road. Western products and advertising are pouring into developing countries.
It is creating a groundwork for an incredible global disaster.
Combined with a population explosion not expected to peak for decades, the consumption boom threatens to devour the world's reserves of oil and other resources within the lifetime of our grandchildren. We've set the example.
The American consumer. Each year you consume fantastic amounts of food, clothing, housing, amusements, appliances, and services of all kinds.
Since 1950, Americans alone have used more resources than everyone who ever lived before them.
How's that for a statistic? the last 50 years, that population in the United States has used more resources than anyone total before them. And that's with that 50 years is the consumer economics era, the Victor Lebeau era, the production and consumption. So, problems. Here's the list. Consumption, unlimited. It's not sustainable. This is their term. Uneconomic growth and expansion. It divides people, sections of society, the haves and the have-nots. It makes people less happy, although it's supposed to make people more happy. They become very vicious in their dealings and relationships, especially when it comes to resources. Environmentally, it's a disaster. Have to go. Yeah, okay. So, we have a big problem. There's something that's fundamentally flawed in just the production-consumption model of consumer economics. So we're going to quickly look at alternative, and very popular today is green. They have like a branch of the U.S. government that certified, just like they certified organic, is now certified green, because people want to buy green, because there's a lot of promotion of it's important to have green economics. So these are the arguments that are presented in favor of it, or the types of green economy. And it's a very, very large growing industry in the United States. We'll look at some of the reasons why, while it's good, there's some big shortcomings. One of them is it doesn't address the root. The root is consumption. So take all those products and make them green products, and they're still not, it's not a sustainable plan. Here's the economists commenting. Confronting Consumption is the title of the article. Much that is said today in the name of sustainability continues to stress the familiar environmental themes of populations too large, technology not green enough, and economic growth is, there's not enough of it in the right places. Consumption occasionally enters the discussion, but only in non-threatening ways, and most often in the form of calls for green consumption, or support of some moral imperative to consume recycled and or recyclable products. But the root isn't addressed. Much of this sustainable development talk steers clear of escalating consumption, especially the root of such escalation. So it doesn't address that the insatiable desire problem that has all these other consequences mentioned previously. And another is that there's severe side effects. We'll take a look at a couple of them. Maybe there's, I would guess, that there's studies here at the university in biofuel, biotechnology. Biofuels have tied oil and food prices together in ways that could profoundly upset the relationships between food producers, consumers. So if you use the land, arable land, for producing ethanol potential crops, the argument is then you're reducing the total number of crops that can be produced for human consumption. I've been at universities where we had this lively dialogue. Well, there are biofuels that have nothing to do with consumable products or use of the land for that way. That is addressed not so long ago in the New York Times. Biofuels that are from non-food crops, like reeds and wild grasses, would offer fuel without the risk of taking food off the table. The Global Invasion Species Program estimates that the damage from invasive species costs the world more than $1.4 trillion annually, 5% of the global economy. So have more of that stuff to use for biofuels and you've solved a problem, created another problem. Or not solved, but you've addressed a problem. And the greenhouse effect. most of the biofuels that people are using or planning to use would probably increase the greenhouse gases substantially. Princeton University researcher. So it's something in the right direction. It doesn't say don't do it, but you know, there's costs involved. Or solar power. Congress has been looking at an act, it may by now have passed it, I'm not sure, where over a period of the next decade, some mega amount of money is to be invested in solar power. And the idea is go to desert areas where there's lots and lots of sun, you're not making an impact on the vegetation as much, and have huge solar production. So persons who have studied this say there's it's impacting biodiversity by doing what they're doing or planning to do what they're doing. And you know, the people on the other side, they respond, you know, what's the big deal? You lose some cactuses, lose their habitation, and some lizards that are running around, they can't run around. So what's the big deal? And then the respondents say, it is a big deal because, one, do we have the right? And two, you make that impact over here and you're going to find impacts and ripple effects outside that's going to directly pinch and hurt. I'll give one example. It's more of a global warming issue, but I visited in British Columbia this past summer, where the persons I was visiting pointed out there's, you know, that all that, the Rocky Mountains from the U.S. going all the way up to Alaska through Canada, huge area. Half of the forests are now gone because of the global warming effect. There was this insect, forget the name of the insect, some kind of a bug, that had its gestation period over the winter, and many of them were killed off because they had long cold winters. But when the long cold winters became less severe, they hatched and they started eating what they had available, that was the trees. So they ate right through the bark of the trees and killed the trees, and now instead of having green mountainside, it's brown mountainsides. And the foresters were thinking, this is great, now we can go and cut down all these trees and we have lots of trees. But that just changing of having no trees, that changes the effect of all the forms of wildlife that were, you know, just the ecosystem is disturbed. And that has its impact then upon human beings. So how we're living our lives while we're trying to create solutions to our need for energy and other forms of consumption in consumer economics, it's not... it's got its problems too. It's good, but it's not enough. It's ineffective for the level of the crisis. And the last point is where we're going next. And then I'll end. The spiritual well-being of the individual isn't being addressed. And that's what the spiritual economic folks are saying. We have to look at the human being as this... who the human being is, not just a machine that consumes, but we have a deeper, more important purpose in our life, and that has to be addressed. Here's a quote from our spiritual master, or my spiritual master, founder of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Years ago, this is in the 60s, he wrote, Advancement of material vision or material civilization is a great stumbling block for spiritual advancement. Such material advancement entangles a living being in the bondage of a material body, followed by all sorts of material miseries. Summarizing what the economists have said. So, by diverting attention to so many unwanted things, human energy is spoiled. Without advancement of spiritualization, the prime necessity of human life. This is his way of expressing the same thing that the spiritual economists are saying. And long ago, this ancient Vedic text addressed the same thing. This is a painting of a forest scene where one sage, his name was Sutta Goswami, he was addressing other sages and they were asking the same question 5,000 years ago. What is it that can be done that will bring ultimate satisfaction, happiness, and well-being to the individual? And the answer is, whatever are our human needs, physical, emotional, psychological needs, they need to be met in terms of the spiritual well-being of the individual. And when the spiritual well-being is placed in that foreground position, the other things follow. So this is now the spiritual economics paradigm, where the spiritual well-being drives the concept of a good economy. So over there is the maximizers and saying no to that arrangement and saying yes to, just in practical terms, speaking really practical terms, how can we lead our lives where spiritual economics is driving what we consume? It doesn't say, so the message is don't consume or buy anything or don't produce anything. But when you are going through the decision process of should I purchase something, consider how does this have benefit for my spiritual well-being? In what way will it impact my spiritual well-being? And think it through a few times before you go ahead and purchase something. When you purchase something, the purpose of that is for spiritual well-being. And when the principle of spiritual economics is make that at the center, is that which drives the production, consumptions of goods and services, you have a spiritual society. So time doesn't permit, so I'm not going to go through all of these, but there are the spiritual economic folks have looked at all of these different categories and analyzed in comparison. I'm just going to do one. From the material economic side, what's important is the body, that I feel good, I look good, I smell good, I'm feeling okay. But the spiritual economics looks at the bigger picture. We actually have a non-material or a spiritual side to our life, and that has to be factored as well. We're multi-dimensional beings, not just what's going to be good for goods and services. So the problem that's addressed is this unhappiness or lack of well-being by seeing to spiritual well-being first and foremost. Very quickly, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna addresses this idea. Here's a statement from the second chapter. When you read this, we'll read this first sentence, think of marketing. While contemplating the objects of the senses, a person develops attachment for them. Marketing is encouraging people to contemplate objects of the senses. And from such attachment, lust develops. And from lust, anger arises. From anger, complete delusion arises. And from delusion, bewilderment of memory. When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost. And when intelligence is lost, one falls down again into the material pool. Krishna's advice to Arjuna here in Bhagavad Gita is stop at that very first stage. The contemplation of the objects for enjoyment should be instead contemplation of what will enhance my spiritual value in life. This is the cover picture of the book Towards a Spiritual Economy, where a lot of this information has been taken from. And how can this be brought into action in the world in a practical way? One is by education, as you see on the left, just a formal classroom type of education where principles of spiritual well-being as we function within society, needs to be contemplated. The other picture is interdenominational, or persons of different persuasions sharing their views and values, how to help move that principle of spiritual well-being further within society by finding satisfaction on a deeper level, by cultural development, helping people to gain a higher taste so that things that are of a lesser taste just don't draw them. And even more practically is establishing models of communities that live by these principles. There are some self-sufficient farm communities where growing their own food, having their own internal economy is an experiment or a pilot effort. And there are a number of places pictured here around the world where those attempts are undergoing. So that covers the topic. It's, I've taken more time than I should have, and apologize for that. So see if there's any comments or questions on what I've covered. Or any thoughts you'd like to share. Abrupt ending. Anything? Okay.
I have a question.
You?
Yes.
Okay.
Self-sustainable society model, what we are having some vision, how big and how large is, rather how small is small? I mean, when we vision about a small independent economy, do we have a vision for how many villages or areas or should be self-sustainable?
How many is, you know, do one at a time. And how large? I don't have an idea of, or like a number of, like how many acres of land is necessary in order to have a unit. I think it's, that would be, how many persons you wish to accommodate would determine how much land you feel that you need. Perhaps the one that I'm aware of that's most successful is a community in Hungary. And except their motto is, except for salt, they don't have to go off the property for anything. They produce it all from the land. And, you know, it takes a serious commitment to be able to, you know, develop things in that way, but the group of persons who are involved, in part it has to do with the country. Hungary has been, Hungary and Poland have been the breadbasket for Europe for, like, you know, centuries. So their service to the rest of Europe is producing agricultural production and, you know, feeding the populace of Europe. So that's been their, you know, given role within European marketplace. So they've been very careful over that period of time of how they're using the land. So there's already this ethos of making things sustainable. So the government has given incentives to create models of sustainability. And there's, out of the many, I've met the persons who are operating this community, and the government has found that this particular one is the best. Because some come and some go. They have high ideals, but they don't maintain them over an extended period of time. But the Hungarian government, they're recognizing this is the one that's most successful. And they ask, you know, what's your secret? And they say, because it's God-centered. that the spiritual well-being is seen. So to get sustainable economy, sustainable agriculture, there has to be a spiritual value at the center. He needs to go, let him go. Is there prasadam here or outside? Or?
Just give the tickets.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.